plans, or they decided to go to a nightclub. I could still lose the bastard, Van Damme thought. There must be a policeman around here somewhere. Hey, he said in a stage whisper, is anybody there? Police! This is Major Van Damme. Hey, where are... A dark figure materialized from behind a tree. An Arab voice said, yes? Hello, I'm Major Van Damme. Are you the police officer watching the houseboat? Yes, sir. Okay, listen. The man we're chasing is on the boat now. Do you have a gun? No, sir. Damn. Van Damme considered whether he and the Arab could raid the boat on their own, and decided they could not. The Arab could not be trusted to fight enthusiastically, and in that confined space, Wolf's knife could wreak havoc. Right. I want you to go to the nearest telephone, ring GHQ, and get a message through to Captain Jakes or Colonel Bogg. Absolutely top priority. They are to come here in force and raid the houseboat immediately. Is that clear? Captain Jakes or Colonel Bogg, GHQ, they are to raid the houseboat immediately. Yes, sir. All right, be quick. The Arab left at a trot. Van Damme found a position in which he was concealed from view, but could still watch the houseboat and the towpath. A few minutes later, the figure of a woman came along the path. Van Damme thought she looked familiar. She boarded the houseboat, and Van Damme realized she was Sonia. He was relieved. At least Wolf could not molest Elena while there was another woman on the boat. He settled down to wait. Chapter 22. The Arab was worried. Go to the nearest telephone, the Englishman had said. Well, there were telephones in some of the nearby houses. But houses with phones were occupied by Europeans who would not take kindly to an Egyptian, even a police officer, banging on their doors at 11 o'clock at night and demanding to use the phone. They would almost certainly refuse with oaths and curses. It would be a humiliating experience. He was not in uniform. Not even wearing his usual plain clothes outfit of white shirt and black trousers, but was dressed like a fellah. They would not even believe he was a policeman. There were no public phones on Zamalek that he knew of. That left him only one option, to phone from the station house. He headed that way, still trotting. He was also worried about calling GHQ. It was an unwritten rule for Egyptian officials in Cairo that no one ever voluntarily contacted the British. It always meant trouble. The switchboard at GHQ would refuse to put through the call, or they would leave the message until morning, then deny they had ever received it, or they would tell him to call back later. And if anything went wrong, there would be hell to pay. How, anyway, did he know that the man on the towpath had been genuine? He did not know Major Van Damme from Adam, and anyone could put on the uniform shirt of a major. Suppose it was a hoax. There was a certain type of young English officer who just loved to play practical jokes on well-meaning Egyptians. He had a standard response to situations like this. Pass the buck. Anyway, he had been instructed to report to his superior officer and no one else on this case. He would go to the station house, and from there, he decided, he would call Superintendent Kamel at home. Kamel would know what to do. Elena stepped off the ladder and looked nervously around the interior of the houseboat. She had expected the decor to be sparse and nautical. In fact, it was luxurious, if a little overripe. There were thick rugs, low divans, a couple of elegant occasional tables, and rich velvet floor-to-ceiling curtains which divided this area from the other half of the boat, which was presumably the bedroom. Opposite the curtains, where the boat narrowed to what had been its stern, was a tiny kitchen with small but modern fittings. "Is this yours?" she asked Wolf. "It belongs to a friend," he said. "Do sit down." Elena felt trapped. Where the hell was William Van Damme? Several times during the evening she had thought there was a motorcycle behind the car, but she had been unable to look carefully for fear of alerting Wolf. Every second she had been expecting soldiers to surround the car, arrest Wolf, and set her free. And as the seconds turned into hours, she had begun to wonder if it all was a dream, if William Van Damme existed at all. Now Wolf was going to the icebox, taking out a bottle of champagne, finding two glasses, unwrapping the silver foil from the top of the bottle, unwinding the wire fastening, pulling the cork with a loud pop, and pouring the champagne into the glasses. And where the hell was William? She was terrified of Wolf. She had had many liaisons with men, some of them casual, but she had always trusted the man, always known he would be kind, or if not kind, at least considerate. It was her body she was frightened for. If she let Wolf play with her body, what kind of games would he invent? Her skin was sensitive. She was soft inside, so easy to hurt, so vulnerable lying on her back with her legs apart. To be like that with someone who loved her, someone who would be as gentle with her body as she herself, would be a joy. But with Wolf, who wanted only to use her body, she shuddered. "Are you cold?" Wolf said as he handed her a glass. "No, I wasn't shivering." He raised his glass. "Your health." Her mouth was dry. She sipped the cold wine, then took a gulp. It made her feel a little better. He sat beside her on the couch and twisted around to look at her. "What a super evening," he said. "I enjoy your company so much. You're an enchantress." "Here it comes," she thought. He put his hand on her knee. She froze. "You're enigmatic," he said. "Desirable, rather aloof, very beautiful, sometimes naive and sometimes so knowing. Will you tell me something?" "I expect so." She did not look at him. With his fingertip he traced the silhouette of her face, forehead, nose, lips, chin. He said, "Why do you go out with me?" What did he mean? Was it possible he suspected what she was really doing? Or was this just the next move in the game? She looked at him and said, "You're a very attractive man." "I'm glad you think so." He put his hand on her knee again and leaned forward to kiss her. She offered him her cheek, as she had done once before this evening. His lips brushed her skin. Then he whispered, "Why are you frightened of me?" There was a noise up on deck, quick, light footsteps, and then the hatch opened. Elena thought, "William!" A high-heeled shoe and a woman's foot appeared. The woman came down, closing the hatch above her, and stepped off the ladder. Elena saw her face and recognized her as Sonia, the belly dancer. She thought, "What on earth is going on?" "All right, Sergeant," Kamel said into the telephone. "You did exactly the right thing in contacting me. I'll deal with everything myself. In fact, you may go off duty now." "Thank you, sir," said the sergeant. "Good night." "Good night." Kamel hung up. This was a catastrophe. The British had followed Alex Wolf to the houseboat, and Van Damme was trying to organize a raid. The consequences would be twofold. First, the prospect of the free officers using the Germans' radio would vanish. And then there would be no possibility of negotiations with the Reich before Rommel conquered Egypt. Second, once the British discovered that the houseboat was a nest of spies, they would quickly figure out that Kamel had been concealing the facts and protecting the agents. Kamel regretted that he had not pushed Sonia harder, forced her to arrange a meeting within hours instead of days. But it was too late for regrets. What was he going to do now? He went back into the bedroom and dressed quickly. From the bed, his wife said softly, "What is it?" "Work," he whispered. "Oh, no." She turned over. He took his pistol from the locked drawer in the desk and put it in his jacket pocket. Then he kissed his wife and left the house quietly. He got into his car and started the engine. He sat thinking for a minute. He had to consult Sadat about this, but that would take time. In the meanwhile, Van Damme might grow impatient, waiting at the houseboat, and do something precipitate. Van Damme would have to be dealt with first, quickly. Then he could go to Sadat's house. Kamel pulled away, heading for Zamalek. He wanted time to think, slowly and clearly. But time was what he lacked. Should he kill Van Damme? He had never killed a man, and did not know whether he would be capable of it. It was years since he had so much as hit anyone. And how would he cover up his involvement in all this? It might be days yet before the Germans reached Cairo. Indeed, it was possible, even at this stage, that they might be repulsed. Then there would be an investigation into what had happened on the towpath tonight, and sooner or later, the blame would be laid at Kamel's door. He would probably be shot. "Courage," he said aloud, remembering the way Imam's stolen plane had burst into flames as it crash-landed in the desert. He parked near the towpath. From the trunk of the car, he took a length of rope. He stuffed the rope into the pocket of his jacket and carried the gun in his right hand. He held the gun reversed for clubbing. How long since he had used it? 6 years, he thought, not counting occasional target practice. He reached the riverbank. He looked at the silver Nile, the black shapes of the houseboats, the dim line of the towpath, and the darkness of the bushes. Van Damme would be in the bushes somewhere. Kamel stepped forward, walking softly. Van Damme looked at his wristwatch in the glow of his cigarette. It was 11:30. Clearly, something had gone wrong. Either the Arab policeman had given the wrong message, or GHQ had been unable to locate Jakes, or Bog had somehow fouled everything up. Van Damme could not take the chance of letting Wolf get on the radio with the information he had now. There was nothing for it but to go aboard the houseboat himself and risk everything. He put out his cigarette. Then he heard a footstep somewhere in the bushes. "Who is it?" he hissed. "Jakes?" A dark figure emerged and whispered, "It's me." Van Damme could not recognize the whispered voice, nor could he see the face. "Who?" The figure stepped nearer and raised an arm. Van Damme said, "Who?" Then he realized that the arm was sweeping down in a blow. He jerked sideways, and something hit the side of his head and bounced on his shoulder. Van Damme shouted with pain, and his right arm went numb. The arm was lifted again. Van Damme stepped forward, reaching clumsily for his assailant with his left hand. The figure stepped back and struck again, and this time the blow landed squarely on top of Van Damme's head. There was a moment of intense pain. Then Van Damme lost consciousness. Kamel pocketed the gun and knelt beside Van Damme's prone figure. First he touched Van Damme's chest and was relieved to feel a strong heartbeat. Working quickly, he took off Van Damme's sandals, removed the socks, rolled them into a ball, and stuffed them into the unconscious man's mouth. That should stop him from calling out. Next he rolled Van Damme over, crossed his wrists behind his back, and tied them together with the rope. With the other end of the rope, he bound Van Damme's ankles. Finally, he tied the rope to a tree. Van Damme would come round in a few minutes, but he would find it impossible to move. Nor could he cry out. He would remain there until somebody stumbled on him. How soon was that likely to happen? Normally, there might have been people in these bushes, young men with their sweethearts and soldiers with their girls. But tonight, there had surely been enough comings and goings here to frighten them away. There was a chance that a late-coming couple would see Van Damme, or perhaps hear him groaning. Kamel would have to take that chance. There was no point standing around and worrying. He decided to take a quick look at the houseboat. He walked light-footedly along the towpath to the Jihan. There were lights on inside, but little curtains were drawn across the portholes. He was tempted to go aboard, but he wanted to consult with Sadat first, for he was not sure what should be done. He turned around and headed back toward his car. Sonia said, "Alex has told me all about you, Elena." She smiled. Elena smiled back. Was this the friend of Wolf's who owned the houseboat? Was Wolf living with her? Had he not expected her back so early? Why was neither of them angry, or puzzled, or embarrassed? just for something to say, Elena asked her, "Have you just come from the Cha-Cha Club?" "Yes." "How was it?" "As always, exhausting, thrilling, successful." Sonia was not a humble woman, clearly. Wolf handed Sonia a glass of champagne. She took it without looking at him and said to Elena, "So you work in Mickey's shop?" "No, I don't," Elena said, thinking, "Are you really interested in this?" "I helped him for a few days, that's all. We're related." "So you're Greek?" "That's right." The small talk was giving Elena confidence. Her fear receded. Whatever happened, Wolf was not likely to rape her at knife point in front of one of the most famous women in Egypt. Sonia gave her a breathing space, at least. William was determined to capture Wolf before midnight. Midnight? She had almost forgotten. At midnight, Wolf was to contact the enemy by wireless and hand over the details of the defense line. But where was the radio? Was it here, on the boat? If it was somewhere else, Wolf would have to leave soon. If it was here, would he send his message in front of Elena and Sonia? What was in his mind? He sat down beside Elena. She felt vaguely threatened with the two of them on either side of her. Wolf said, "What a lucky man I am to be sitting here with the two most beautiful women in Cairo." Elena looked straight ahead, not knowing what to say. Wolf said, "Isn't she beautiful, Sonia?" "Oh, yes." Sonia touched Elena's face, then took her chin and turned her head. "Do you think I'm beautiful, Elena?" "Of course." Elena frowned. This was getting weird. It was almost as if... "I'm so glad," Sonia said, and she put her hand on Elena's knee. And then Elena understood. Everything fell into place. Wolf's patience, his phony courtliness, the houseboat, the unexpected appearance of Sonia. Elena realized she was not safe at all. Her fear of Wolf came back stronger than before. The pair of them wanted to use her, and she would have no choice. She would have to lie there, mute and unresisting, while they did whatever they wanted, Wolf with the knife in one hand. "Stop it! I won't be afraid. I can stand being mauled about by a pair of depraved old fools. There's more at stake here. Forget about your precious little body. Think about the radio and how to stop Wolf using it." This threesome might be turned to advantage. She looked furtively at her wristwatch. It was 12:45. Too late now to rely on William. She, Elena, was the only one who could stop Wolf. And she thought she knew how. A look passed between Sonia and Wolf like a signal. Each with a hand on one of Elena's thighs, they leaned across her and kissed each other in front of her eyes. She looked at them. It was a long, lascivious kiss. She thought, "What do they expect me to do?" They drew apart. Wolf kissed Elena the same way. Elena was unresistant. Then she felt Sonia's hand on her chin. Sonia turned Elena's face toward her and kissed her lips. Elena closed her eyes, thinking, "It won't hurt me. It won't hurt." It did not hurt, but it was strange to be kissed so tenderly by a woman's mouth. Elena thought, "Somehow I have to get control of this scene." Sonia pulled open her own blouse. She had big brown breasts. Wolf bent his head and took a nipple into his mouth. Elena felt Sonia pushing her head down. She realized she was supposed to follow Wolf's example. She did so. Sonia moaned. All this was for Sonia's benefit. It was clearly her fantasy, her kink. She was the one who was panting and groaning now, not Wolf. Elena was afraid that any minute now Wolf might break away and go to his radio. As she went mechanically through the motions of making love to Sonia, she cast about in her mind for ways to drive Wolf out of his mind with lust. But the whole scene was so silly, so farcical, that everything she thought of doing seemed merely comical. "I've got to keep Wolf from that radio. What's the key to all this? What do they really want? She moved her face away from Sonia and kissed Wolf. He turned his mouth to hers. She found his hand and pressed it between her thighs. He breathed deeply, and Elena thought, at least he's interested. Sonia tried to push them apart. Wolf looked at Sonia, then slapped her face hard. Elena gasped with surprise. Was this the key? It must be a game they play. It must be. Wolf turned his attention back to Elena. Sonia tried to get between them again. This time, Elena slapped her. Sonia moaned deep in her throat. Elena thought, I've done it. I've guessed the game. I'm in control. She saw Wolf look at his wristwatch. Suddenly, she stood up. They both stared at her. She lifted her arms, then slowly she pulled her dress up over her head, threw it to one side, and stood there in her black underwear and stockings. She touched herself lightly, running her hands between her thighs and across her breasts. She saw Wolf's face change. His look of composure vanished, and he gazed at her, wide-eyed with desire. He was tense, mesmerized. He licked his lips. Elena raised her left foot, planted a high-heeled shoe between Sonia's breasts, and pushed Sonia backward. Then she grasped Wolf's head and drew it to her belly. Sonia started kissing Elena's foot. Wolf made a sound between a groan and a sigh and buried his face between Elena's thighs. Elena looked at her watch. It was midnight.
This ends side two of cassette 7 of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 8. Rebecca, Cassette 8.
Chapter 23. Elena lay on her back in the bed, naked. She was quite still, rigid, her muscles tense, staring straight up at the blank ceiling. On her right was Sonia, face down, arms and legs spread all ways over the sheets, fast asleep, snoring. Sonia's right hand rested limply on Elena's hip. Wolf was on Elena's left. He lay on his side, facing her, sleepily stroking her body. Elena was thinking, well, it didn't kill me. The game had been all about rejecting and accepting Sonia. The more Elena and Wolf rejected her and abused her, the more passionate she became, until, in the denouement, Wolf rejected Elena and made love to Sonia. It was a script that Wolf and Sonia obviously knew well. They had played it before. It had given Elena very little pleasure, but she was not sickened or humiliated or disgusted. What she felt was that she had been betrayed, and betrayed by herself. It was like pawning a jewel given by a lover, or having your long hair cut off to sell for money, or sending a small child to work in a mill. She had abused herself. Worst of all, what she had done was the logical culmination of the life she had been living. In the 8 years since she had left home, she had been on the slippery slope that ended in prostitution, and now she felt she had arrived there. The stroking stopped, and she glanced sideways at Wolf's face. His eyes were closed. He was falling asleep. She wondered what had happened to Van Damme. Something had gone wrong. Perhaps Van Damme had lost sight of Wolf's car in Cairo. Maybe he had had an accident in the traffic. Whatever the reason, Van Damme was no longer watching over her. She was on her own. She had succeeded in making Wolf forget his midnight transmission to Rommel. But what now was to stop him sending the message another night? Elena would have to get to GHQ and tell Jakes where Wolf was to be found. She would have to slip away, right now, find Jakes, get him to pull his team out of bed. It would take too long. Wolf might wake, find she was gone, and vanish again. Was his radio here, on the houseboat, or somewhere else? That might make all the difference. She remembered something Van Damme had said last evening. Was it really only a few hours ago? If I can get the key to the Rebecca code, I can impersonate him over the radio. It could turn the tables completely. Elena thought, perhaps I can find the key. He had said it was a sheet of paper explaining how to use the book to encode messages. Elena realized that she now had a chance to locate the radio and the key to the code. She had to search the houseboat. She did not move. She was frightened again. If Wolf should discover her searching, she remembered his theory of human nature. The world is divided into masters and slaves. A slave's life was worth nothing. No, she thought. I'll leave here in the morning, quite normally, and then I'll tell the British where Wolf is to be found, and they'll raid the houseboat and... And what if Wolf had gone by then? What if the radio was not here? Then it would all have been for nothing. Wolf's breathing was now slow and even. He was fast asleep. Elena reached down, gently picked up Sonia's limp hand, and moved it from her thigh onto the sheet. Sonia did not stir. Now neither of them was touching Elena. It was a great relief. Slowly, she sat upright. The shift of weight on the mattress disturbed both of the other two. Sonia grunted, lifted her head, turned it the other way, and fell to snoring again. Wolf rolled over on his back without opening his eyes. Moving slowly, wincing with every movement of the mattress, Elena turned around so that she was on her hands and knees, facing the head of the bed. She began painfully to crawl backward. Right knee, left hand. Left knee, right hand. She watched the two sleeping faces. The foot of the bed seemed miles away. The silence rang in her ears like thunder. The houseboat itself rocked from side to side on the wash of a passing barge, and Elena backed off the bed quickly under cover of the disturbance. She stood there, rooted to the spot, watching the other two until the boat stopped moving. They stayed asleep. Where should the search start? Elena decided to be methodical and begin at the front and work backward. In the prow of the boat was the bathroom. Suddenly she realized she had to go there anyway. She tiptoed across the bedroom and went into the tiny bathroom. Sitting on the toilet, she looked around. Where might a radio be hidden? She did not really know how big it would be. The size of a suitcase? A briefcase? A handbag? Here there were a basin, a small tub, and a cupboard on the wall. She stood up and opened the cupboard. It contained shaving gear, pills, and a small roll of bandage. The radio was not in the bathroom. She did not have the courage to search the bedroom while they slept. Not yet. She crossed it and passed through the curtains into the living room. She looked quickly all around. She felt the need to hurry and forced herself to be calm and careful. She began on the starboard side. Here there was a divan couch. She tapped its base gently. It seemed hollow. The radio might be underneath. She tried to lift it and could not. Looking around its edge, she saw that it was screwed to the floor. The screws were tight. The radio would not be there. Next, there was a tall cupboard. She opened it gently. It squeaked a little, and she froze. She heard a grunt from the bedroom. She waited for Wolf to come bounding through the curtains and catch her red-handed. Nothing happened. She looked in the cupboard. There was a broom and some dusters and cleaning materials and a flashlight. No radio. She closed the door. It squeaked again. She moved into the kitchen area. She had to open six smaller cupboards. They contained crockery, tinned food, saucepans, glasses, supplies of coffee and rice and tea, and towels. Under the sink there was a bucket for kitchen waste. Elena looked in the icebox. It contained one bottle of champagne. There were several drawers. Would the radio be small enough to fit in a drawer? She opened one. The rattle of cutlery shredded her nerves. No radio. Another, a massive selection of bottled spices and flavorings, from vanilla essence to curry powder. Somebody liked to cook. Another drawer. Kitchen knives. Next to the kitchen was a small escritoire with a fold-down desktop. Beneath it was a small suitcase. Elena picked up the suitcase. It was heavy. She opened it. There was the radio. Her heart skipped. It was an ordinary plain suitcase with two catches, a leather handle, and reinforced corners. The radio fitted inside exactly as if it had been designed that way. The recessed lid left a little room on top of the radio, and here there was a book. Its board covers had been torn off to make it fit into the space in the lid. Elena picked up the book and looked inside. She read, "Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again." It was Rebecca. She flicked the pages of the book. In the middle, there was something between the pages. She let the book fall open, and a sheet of paper dropped to the floor. She bent down and picked it up. It was a list of numbers and dates, with some words in German. This was surely the key to the code. She held in her hand what Van Damme needed to turn the tide of the war. Suddenly, the responsibility weighed her down. Without this, she thought, Wolf cannot send messages to Rommel. Or if he sends messages in plain language, the Germans will suspect their authenticity and also worry that the Allies have overheard them. Without this, Wolf is useless. With this, Van Damme can win the war. She had to run away, now taking the key with her. She remembered that she was stark naked. She broke out of her trance. Her dress was on the couch, crumpled and wrinkled. She crossed the boat, put down the book and the key to the code, picked up her dress, and slipped it over her head. The bed creaked. From behind the curtains came the unmistakable sound of someone getting up, someone heavy. It had to be him. Elena stood still, paralyzed. She heard Wolf walk toward the curtains, then away again. She heard the bathroom door. There was no time to put her panties on. She picked up her bag, her shoes, and the book with the key inside. She heard Wolf come out of the bathroom. She went to the ladder and ran up it, wincing as her bare feet cut into the edges of the narrow wooden steps. Glancing down, she saw Wolf appear between the curtains and glance up at her in astonishment. His eyes went to the suitcase opened on the floor. Elena looked away from him to the hatch. It was secured on the inside with two bolts. She slid them both back. From the corner of her eye, she saw Wolf dash to the ladder. She pushed up the hatch and scrambled out. As she stood upright on the deck, she saw Wolf scrambling up the ladder. She bent swiftly and lifted the heavy wooden hatch. As Wolf's right hand grasped the rim of the opening, Elena slammed the hatch down on his fingers with all her might. There was a roar of pain. Elena ran across the deck and down the gangplank. It was just that, a plank leading from the deck to the riverbank. She stooped, picked up the end of the plank, and threw it into the river. Wolf came up through the hatch, his face a mask of pain and fury. Elena panicked as she saw him come across the deck at a run. She thought, "He's naked. He can't chase me." He took a flying jump over the rail of the boat. "He can't make it." He landed on the very edge of the riverbank, his arms windmilling for balance. Elena ran at him, and while he was still off balance, pushed him backward into the water. She turned and ran along the towpath. When she reached the lower end of the pathway that led to the street, she stopped and looked back. Already her heart was pounding, and she was breathing in long, shuddering gasps. She felt elated when she saw Wolf, dripping wet and naked, climbing out of the water up the muddy riverbank. It was getting light. He could not chase her far in that state. She spun around toward the street, broke into a run, and crashed into someone. Strong arms caught her in a tight grip. She struggled desperately, got free, and was seized again. She slumped in defeat. After all that, she thought. After all that. She was turned around, grasped by the arms, and marched toward the houseboat. She saw Wolf walking toward her. She struggled again, and the man holding her got an arm around her throat. She opened her mouth to scream for help, but before she could make a sound, the man had thrust his fingers down her throat, making her retch. Wolf came up and said, "Who are you?"
"I'm Kamel. You must be Wolf."
"Thank God you are there."
"You're in trouble, Wolf," said the man called Kamel.
"You'd better come aboard." "Oh, shit, she threw away the fucking plank."
Wolf looked down at the river and saw the plank floating beside the houseboat.
"I can't get any weather," he said.
He slid down the bank and into the water, grabbed the plank, shoved it up onto the bank, and climbed up after it. He picked it up again and laid it across the gap between the houseboat and the bank.
"This way," he said.
Kamel marched Elena across the plank, over the deck, and down the ladder.
"Put her over there," Wolf said, pointing to the couch.
Kamel pushed Elena over to the couch, not ungently, and made her sit down. Wolf went through the curtains and came back a moment later with a big towel. He proceeded to rub himself dry with it. He seemed quite unembarrassed by his nakedness. Elena was surprised to see that Kamel was quite a small man. From the way he had grabbed her, she had imagined he was Wolf's build. He was a handsome, dark-skinned Arab. He was looking away from Wolf uneasily. Wolf wrapped the towel around his waist and sat down. He examined his hand.
"She nearly broke my fingers," he said.
He looked at Elena with a mixture of anger and amusement.
Kamel said, "Where's Sonia?"
"In bed," Wolf said, jerking his head toward the curtains. "She sleeps through earthquakes, especially after a night of lust."
Kamel was uncomfortable with such talk, Elena observed, and perhaps also impatient with Wolf's levity.
"You're in trouble," he said again.
"I know," Wolf said. "I suppose she's working for Van Damme."
"I don't know about that. I got a call in the middle of the night from my man on the towpath. Van Damme had come along and sent my man to fetch help."
Wolf was shocked. "We came close," he said. He looked worried. "Where's Van Damme now?"
"Out there still. I knocked him on the head and tied him up."
Elena's heart sank. Van Damme was out there in the bushes, hurt and incapacitated, and nobody else knew where she was. It had all been for nothing, after all.
Wolf nodded. "Van Damme followed her here. That's two people who know about this place. If I stay here, I'll have to kill them both."
Elena shuddered. He talked of killing people so lightly. Masters and slaves, she remembered.
"Not good enough," Kamel said. "If you kill Van Damme, the murder will eventually be blamed on me. You can go away, but I have to live in this town."
He paused, watching Wolf with narrowed eyes.
"And if you were to kill me, that would still leave the man who called me last night."
"So," Wolf frowned and made an angry noise. "There's no choice. I have to go. Damn."
Kamel nodded.
"If you disappear, I think I can cover up. But I want something from you. Remember the reason we've been helping you."
"You want to talk to Rommel?"
"Yes."
"I'll be sending a message tomorrow night. Tonight, I mean. Damn, I've hardly slept. Tell me what you want to say and I'll..."
"Not good enough," Kamel interrupted. "We want to do it ourselves. We want your radio."
Wolf frowned. Elena realized that Kamel was a nationalist rebel, cooperating or trying to cooperate with the Germans. Kamel added,
"We could send you a message for you."
"Not necessary," Wolf said.
He seemed to have reached a decision.
"I have another radio."
"It's agreed then."
"There's the radio."
Wolf pointed to the open case still on the floor where Elena had left it.
"It's already tuned to the correct wavelength. All you have to do is broadcast at midnight, any night."
Kamel went over to the radio and examined it. Elena wondered why Wolf had said nothing about the Rebecca code. Wolf did not care whether Kamel got through to Rommel or not, she decided. And to give him the code would be to risk that he might give it to someone else. Wolf was playing safe again. Wolf said, "Where does Van Damme live?" Kamel told him the address. Elena thought, now what is he after? Wolf said, "He's married, I suppose?" "No. A bachelor. Damn." "Not a bachelor," Kamel said, still looking at the wireless transmitter. "A widower. His wife was killed in Crete last year."
"Any children?"
"Yes," Kamel said. "A small boy called Billy, so I'm told."
"Why?" Wolf shrugged. "I'm interested, a little obsessed with the man who's come so close to catching me."
Elena was sure he was lying. Kamel closed the suitcase, apparently satisfied. Wolf said to him, "Keep an eye on her for a minute, would you?"
"Of course."
Wolf turned away, then turned back. He had noticed that Elena still had Rebecca in her hand. He reached down and took it from her. He disappeared through the curtains. Elena thought, if I tell Kamel about the code, then maybe Kamel will make Wolf give it to him, and maybe then Van Damme will get it from Wolf. But what will happen to me? Kamel said to her, "What?" He stopped abruptly as Wolf came back, carrying his clothes, and began to dress. Kamel said to him, "Do you have a call sign?"
"Sphinx," Wolf said shortly.
"A code?"
"No code."
"What was in that book?"
Wolf looked angry. "A code," he said. "But you can't have it."
"We need it."
"I can't give it to you," Wolf said. "You'll have to take your chance and broadcast in clear."
Kamel nodded. Suddenly, Wolf's knife was in his hand.
"Don't argue," he said. "I know you've got a gun in your pocket. Remember, if you shoot, you'll have to explain the bullet to the British. You'd better go now."
Kamel turned without speaking and went up the ladder and through the hatch. Elena heard his footsteps above. Wolf went to the porthole and watched him walk away along the towpath. Wolf put his knife away and buttoned his shirt over the sheath. He put on his shoes and laced them tightly. He got the book from the next room, extracted from it the sheet of paper bearing the key to the code, crumpled the paper, dropped it into a large glass ashtray, took a box of matches from a kitchen drawer, and set fire to the paper. He must have another key with the other radio, Elena thought. Wolf watched the flames to make sure the paper was entirely burned. He looked at the book as if contemplating burning that too. Then he opened a porthole and dropped it into the river. He took a small suitcase from a cupboard and began to pack a few things into it.
"Where are you going?" Elena said. "You'll find out. You're coming."
Oh, no. What would he do with her? He had caught her deceiving him. Had he dreamed up some appropriate punishment? She felt very weary and afraid. Nothing she had done had turned out well. At one time she'd been afraid merely that she would have to have sex with him. How much more there was to fear now. She thought of trying again to run away. She had almost made it last time. But she no longer had the spirit. Wolf continued packing his case. Elena saw some of her own clothes on the floor and remembered that she had not dressed properly. There were her panties, her stockings, and her brassiere. She decided to put them on. She stood up and pulled a dress over her head. She bent down to pick up her underwear. As she stood up, Wolf embraced her. He pressed a rough kiss against her lips, not seeming to care that she was completely unresponsive. He reached between her legs and thrust a finger inside her. He withdrew his finger from her vagina and shoved it into her anus. She tensed. He pushed his finger in farther, and she gasped with pain. He looked into her eyes. "Do you know, I think I'd take you with me even if I didn't have a use for you." She closed her eyes, humiliated. He turned from her abruptly and returned to his packing. She put on her clothes. When he was ready, he took a last look around and said, "Let's go." Elena followed him up onto the deck, wondering what he planned to do about Sonia. As if he knew what she was thinking, he said,
I hate to disturb Sonia's beauty sleep. He grinned. Get moving.
They walked along the towpath. Why was he leaving Sonia behind? Elena wondered. She could not figure it out, but she knew it was callous. Wolf was a completely unscrupulous man, she decided, and the thought made her shudder, for she was in his power. She wondered whether she could kill him. He carried his case in his left hand and gripped her arm with his right. They turned onto the footpath, walked to the street, and went to his car. He unlocked the door on the driver's side and made her climb in over the gear stick to the passenger side. He got in beside her and started the car. It was a miracle the car was still in one piece after being left on the road all night. Normally, anything detachable would have been stolen, including wheels. He gets all the luck there is, Elena thought. They drove away. Elena wondered where they were going. Wherever it was, Wolf's second radio was there, along with another copy of Rebecca and another key to the code. When we get there, I'll have to try again, she thought wearily. It was all up to her now. Wolf had left the houseboat, so there was nothing Van Damme could do even after somebody untied him. Elena, on her own, had to try to stop Wolf from contacting Rommel, and if possible, steal the key to the code. The idea was ridiculous. Shooting for the moon. All she really wanted was to get away from this evil, dangerous man. To go home. To forget about spies and codes and war. To feel safe again. She thought of her father walking to Jerusalem, and she knew she had to try. Wolf stopped the car. Elena realized where they were. She said, This is Van Damme's house.
Yes.
She gazed at Wolf, trying to read the expression on his face. She said, But Van Damme isn't there.
No. Wolf smiled bleakly. But Billy is.
Chapter 24 Anwar el-Sadat was delighted with the radio. It's a Halicrafter, Sky Challenger, he told Kamel. American. He plugged it in to test it, and pronounced it very powerful. Kamel explained that he had to broadcast at midnight on the preset wavelength, and that the call sign was Sphinx. He said that Wolf had refused to give him the code, and that they would have to take the risk of broadcasting in clear. They hid the radio in the oven in the kitchen of the little house. Kamel left Sadat's home and drove from Kubri al-Kuba back to Zamalek. On the way, he considered how he was to cover up his role in the events of the night. His story would have to tally with that of the sergeant whom Van Damme had sent for help. So he would have to admit that he had received the phone call. Perhaps he would say that, before alerting the British, he had gone to the houseboat himself to investigate, in case Major Van Damme was an impostor. What then? He had searched the towpath and the bushes for Van Damme, and then he too had been knocked on the head. The snag was that he would not have stayed unconscious all these hours. So he would have to say that he had been tied up. Yes, he would say he had been tied up and had just managed to free himself. Then he and Van Damme would board the houseboat and find it empty. It would serve. He parked his car and went cautiously down to the towpath. Looking into the shrubbery, he figured out roughly where he had left Van Damme. He went into the bushes 30 or 40 yards away from that spot. He lay down on the ground and rolled over to make his clothes dirty. Then he rubbed some of the sandy soil on his face and ran his fingers through his hair. Then, rubbing his wrists to make them look sore, he went in search of Van Damme. He found him exactly where he had left him. The bonds were still tight, and the gag still in place. Van Damme looked at Kamel with wide, staring eyes. Kamel said, My God, they got you too! He bent down, removed the gag, and began to untie Van Damme. The sergeant contacted me, he explained. I came down here looking for you, and the next thing I knew, I woke up bound and gagged with a headache. That was hours ago. I just got free. Van Damme said nothing. Kamel threw the rope aside. Van Damme stood up stiffly. Kamel said,
How do you feel?
I'm all right.
Let's board the houseboat and see what we can find, Kamel said.
He turned around. As soon as Kamel turned his back, Van Damme stepped forward and hit him as hard as he possibly could with an edge-of-the-hand blow to the back of the neck. It might have killed Kamel, but Van Damme did not care. Van Damme had been bound and gagged, and he'd been unable to see the towpath. But he had been able to hear, I'm Kamel. You must be Wolf. That was how he knew that Kamel had betrayed him. Kamel had not thought of that possibility, obviously. Since overhearing those words, Van Damme had been seething, and all his pent-up anger had gone into the blow. Kamel lay on the ground, stunned. Van Damme rolled him over, searched him, and found the gun. He used the rope that had bound his own hands to tie Kamel's hands behind his back. Then he slapped Kamel's face until he came around. Get up, Van Damme said. Kamel looked blank. Then fear came into his eyes. What are you doing? Van Damme kicked him. Kicking you, he said. Get up. Kamel struggled to his feet. Turn around. Kamel turned around. Van Damme took hold of Kamel's collar with his left hand, keeping the gun in his right. Move. They walked to the houseboat. Van Damme pushed Kamel ahead, up the gangplank and across the deck. Open the hatch. Kamel put the toe of his shoe into the handle of the hatch and lifted it open. Go down. Awkwardly, with his hands tied, Kamel descended the ladder. Van Damme bent down to look inside. There was nobody there. He went quickly down the ladder. Pushing Kamel to one side, he pulled back the curtain, covering the space behind with the gun. He saw Sonia in bed, sleeping. Get in there, he told Kamel. Kamel went through and stood beside the head of the bed. Wake her. Kamel touched Sonia with his foot. She turned over, rolling away from him, without opening her eyes. Van Damme realized vaguely that she was naked. He reached over and tweaked her nose. She opened her eyes and sat up immediately, looking cross. She recognized Kamel. Then she saw Van Damme with the gun. She said, What's going on? Then she and Van Damme said simultaneously, Where's Wolf? Van Damme was quite sure she was not dissembling. It was clear now that Kamel had warned Wolf, and Wolf had fled without waking Sonia. Presumably he had taken Elena with him, although Van Damme could not imagine why. Van Damme put the gun to Sonia's chest, just below her left breast. He spoke to Kamel. I'm going to ask you a question. If you give the wrong answer, she dies. Understand? Kamel nodded tensely. Van Damme said, Did Wolf send a radio message at midnight last night? No, Sonia screamed. No, he didn't, he didn't. What did happen here? Van Damme asked, dreading the answer. We went to bed. Who did? Wolf, Elena, and me. Together? Yes. So that was it. And Van Damme had thought she was safe, because there was another woman around. That explained Wolf's continuing interest in Elena. They had wanted her for their threesome. Van Damme was sick with disgust, not because of what they had done, but because he had caused Elena to be forced to be part of it. He put the thought out of his mind. Was Sonia telling the truth? Had Wolf failed to radio Rommel last night? Van Damme could not think of a way to check. He could only hope it was true. Get dressed, he told Sonia. She got off the bed and hurriedly put on a dress. Keeping both of them covered with the gun, Van Damme went to the prow of the boat and looked through the little doorway. He saw a tiny bathroom with two small portholes. Get in there, both of you. Kamel and Sonia went into the bathroom. Van Damme closed the door on them and began to search the houseboat. He opened all the cupboards and drawers, throwing their contents on the floor. He stripped the bed. With a sharp knife from the kitchen, he slashed the mattress and the upholstery of the couch. He went through all the papers in the escritoire. He found a large glass ashtray full of charred paper and poked through it, but all of the paper was completely burned up. He emptied the icebox. He went up on deck and cleaned out the lockers. He checked all around the outside of the hull, looking for a rope dangling into the water. After half an hour, he was sure that the houseboat contained no radio, no copy of Rebecca, and no code key. He got the two prisoners out of the bathroom. In one of the deck lockers, he found a length of rope. He tied Sonia's hands, then roped Sonia and Kamel together. He marched them off the boat, along the towpath, and up to the street. They walked to the bridge, where he hailed a taxi. He put Sonia and Kamel in the back, then, keeping the gun pointed at them, he got in the front beside the wide-eyed, frightened Arab driver. GHQ, he told the driver. The two prisoners would have to be interrogated, but really, there were only two questions to be asked. Where was Wolf? And where was Elena? Sitting in the car, Wolf took hold of Elena's wrist. She tried to pull away, but his grip was too strong. He drew out his knife and ran its blade lightly across the back of her hand. The knife was very sharp. Elena stared at her hand in horror. At first there was just a line like a pencil mark. Then blood welled up in the cut, and there was a sharp pain. She gasped. Wolf said, "You're to stay very close to me and say nothing." Suddenly, Elena hated him. She looked into his eyes. "Otherwise, you'll cut me?" she said with all the scorn she could muster. "No," he said. "Otherwise, I'll cut Billy." He released her wrist and got out of the car. Elena sat still, feeling helpless. What could she do against this strong, ruthless man? She took a little handkerchief from her bag and wrapped it around her bleeding hand. Impatiently, Wolf came around to her side of the car and pulled open the door. He took hold of her upper arm and made her get out of the car. Then, still holding her, he crossed the road to Van Damme's house. They walked up the short drive and rang the bell. Elena remembered the last time she had stood in this portico waiting for the door to open. It seemed years ago, but it was only days. Since then, she had learned that Van Damme had been married and that his wife had died, and she had made love to Van Damme, and he had failed to send her flowers. How could she have made such a fuss about that? And they had found Wolf. And the door opened. Elena recognized Gafar. The servant remembered her, too, and said, "Good morning, Miss Fontana." "Hello, Gafar," Wolf said. "Good morning, Gafar. I'm Captain Alexander. The Major asked me to come around. Let us in, would you?"
"Of course, sir."
Gafar stood aside. Wolf, still gripping Elena's arm, stepped into the house. Gafar closed the door. Elena remembered this tiled hall. Gafar said,
"I hope the Major is all right."
"Yes, he's fine," Wolf said. "But he can't get home this morning, so he asked me to come around, tell you that he's well, and drive Billy to school."
Elena was aghast. It was awful. Wolf was going to kidnap Billy. She should have guessed that as soon as Wolf mentioned the boy's name. But it was unthinkable. She must not let it happen. What could she do? She wanted to shout, "No, Gafar, he's lying. Take Billy and get away. Run, run." But Wolf had the knife, and Gafar was old, and Wolf would get Billy anyway. Gafar seemed to hesitate. Wolf said,
"All right, Gafar, snap it up. We haven't got all day."
"Yes, sir,"
Gafar said, reacting with the reflex of an Egyptian servant addressed in an authoritative manner by a European.
"Billy is just finishing his breakfast. Would you wait in here for a moment?"
He opened the drawing room door. Wolf propelled Elena into the room and at last let go of her arm. Elena looked at the upholstery, the wallpaper, the marble fireplace, and the Tatler photographs of Angela Van Damme. These things had the eerie look of familiar objects seen in a nightmare. Angela would have known what to do, Elena thought miserably. "Don't be ridiculous," she would have said. Then, raising an imperious arm, she would have told Wolf to get out of her house. Elena shook her head to dispel the fantasy. Angela would have been as helpless as she. Wolf sat down at the desk. He opened a drawer, took out a pad and pencil, and began to write. Elena wondered what Gafar might do. Was it possible he might call GHQ to check with Billy's father? Egyptians were very reluctant to make phone calls to GHQ, Elena knew. Gafar would have trouble getting past the switchboard operators and secretaries. She looked around and saw that anyway the phone was here in this room, so that if Gafar tried, Wolf would know and stop him. "Why did you bring me here?" she cried. Frustration and fear made her voice shrill. Wolf looked up from his writing. "To keep the boy quiet. We've got a long way to go." "Leave Billy here," she pleaded. "He's a child."
"Van Damme's child," Wolf said with a smile.
"You don't need him."
"Van Damme may be able to guess where I'm going," Wolf said. "I want to make sure he doesn't come after me."
"Do you really think he'll sit at home while you have his son?"
Wolf appeared to consider the point. "I hope so," he said finally. "Anyway, what have I got to lose? If I don't take the boy, he'll definitely come after me."
Elena fought back tears. "Haven't you got any pity?"
"Pity is a decadent emotion," Wolf said with a gleam in his eye. "Skepticism regarding morality is what is decisive. The end of the moral interpretation of the world, which no longer has any sanction."
He seemed to be quoting. Elena said, "I don't think you're doing this to make Van Damme stay home. I think you're doing it out of spite. You're thinking about the anguish you'll cause him, and you love it. You're a crude, twisted, loathsome man."
"Perhaps you're right."
"You're sick. That's enough." Wolf reddened slightly. He appeared to calm himself with an effort.
"Shut up while I'm writing."
Elena forced herself to concentrate. They were going on a long journey. He was afraid Van Damme would follow them. He had told Kamel he had another wireless set. Van Damme might be able to guess where they were going. At the end of the journey, surely, there was the spare radio, with a copy of Rebecca, and a copy of the key to the code. Somehow she had to help Van Damme follow them, so that he could rescue them and capture the key.